recovering alcoholic. My name is Paulie. And if you're new or you're coming back, welcome home. You're off the hook, and that's what was told to me a long time ago. You know, just for the record, James, and where's that other cowboy guy, Tom, Don, what's his name? John. That's the way I looked when I got sober. So, you know, they told me to change, so I started eating cheeseburgers. You know, I had the tattoos ripped off. Threw the cowboy hat in the canal. Anyway, you know, he said I'm funny. Funny how? No, but the key is that if I wasn't having fun, why would I come here? You know, there's a lot of serious people in AA, and that's great. And the program is 1,000,000% serious. It's just not the way I got it. And so the way I got it is the only way I can give it. And I thank God for some incredible sponsorship. And for however many of the steps you're going to be here for, you're going to hear me talk over and over and over about some men, mentors, sponsors, people that carried me on their shoulders from the gutters of life when I got here. And they both passed sober, the two main guys. They had what I want. I did what they did. It's real simple. Okay, you know, I saw a ton of these vans out here. I mean, that's great. The object, probably in case they didn't tell you, the object in Alcoholics Anonymous is to get to a meeting on your own. When we get to the second step next week, and if you're in one of those places where they say, time to get on the van, it's because you're nuts. You can't be out there alone. Phew. I don't know. What can I tell you? Some guy came up to me at the beginning of the meeting. James was there. He says, you remember me? I don't know. 10 years ago, he says, you picked me up downtown Broward Boulevard. I didn't know if it was one of those pickups. But then he said that, yeah, and then he's always bouncing and bouncing. He says, yeah. So I said, what's the house doing? He looked good. He said, yeah, I'm in this halfway house. Come on. Don't pick up the first one. You can't get loaded. If you don't get loaded, your life's going to get better. If you get loaded, your life's going to get worse. I mean, that's really as simple as it is, okay? You know, he spoke about Russell, and Russell and I screw around. We have amazing respect for each other. We love each other. And we do the thing the same way, pretty much. A strong, overwhelming belief in a power greater than ourselves that has restored us to sanity, that has allowed and prevented us, or me, from picking up that first chemical. And, you know, I'm going to tell a little bit of my story. Actually, the longer I'm sober, the less the first step is really, I mean, of course it's very important, it's what you got to do, but the less it really, you know, does it for me. Because my story happened. And, you know, whatever, if you're sitting here, your story happened. It's over, that part. You don't need to leave here, because many people leave and never get back. So, I'm just going to tell a little bit of my story, and then we'll get into the first step. We'll probably touch on a few other things, and I'm sure we will. And just for the record, by the way, I lost 25 pounds, just like Russell. I think I did it before him. So what's happening is I'm back to becoming a chick magnet. So, which I was when I got here. And so actually, tonight when I was leaving the house, my wife says, you know what, honey? As long as you're back to being a chick magnet, why don't you wear your wedding band? Because I haven't worn it lately. I don't wear it when I play golf. In case you have a hearing problem, I'm from New York City. And actually, some guys visiting there. Oh, yeah, there's a bunch of you Boston guys. Yeah, because Eddie's here, obviously. You can tell the Boston guys, they're white and wearing red. That's like a typical Boston guy. And I just came from Tampa today because I was over yesterday at spring training. And because I'm friendly with a lot of the management of the Yankees, they have a private Yankee party there every year, every spring training. So I was there yesterday as we played the Red Sox. And then I went to the party last night with my son, and I drove home today from Tampa. That's part of what sobriety's about, okay? It wasn't the way it was when I got here. I'm from Queens in New York City, and I'm from the 60s, you know. Turn on, tune in, and drop out, and that's what I did. I drank and used myself into oblivion. The Beatles, you remember the Beatles, right? You know, it's like really good on some level and sad on another. Is these days a lot of the young kids in treatment, you know, like they're 17, they're 19, they're 18, and this group isn't, which I like. Because the last time I spoke in front of one of those groups, people came up, they came up after this, you remind me of my grandfather. So I'm not really ready for that message either. So anyway, the Beatles came to Shea Stadium in 1965. And I'm from Queens, which is right there. And, you know, a few of us, we stormed the fences. We saw the Beatles. And I woke up 15 years later. That's my story. Those 15 years were mostly filled with hell, misery, and degradation. Those 15 years, actually not, the first 4 years were cute. I mean, booze and drugs from 65 to 69, it did it for me. I didn't have any issues. I went full bore, that's the way I do things. You know, 100% all out from the minute I do something, whatever it is. And by 1969, I was finished. I wanted to stop. I'd already been arrested a couple of times, and I was strung out on some other forms of alcohol, the types you put in needles and shoot in your arm. And my life was in the toilet. I had gone from this good family, my parents, two parents, loved each other, no alcoholism, no addiction in my whole family, and I became the scourge of my family. I became the cancer in my family. I became the person that nobody wanted around. I became the person that, at the end of the deal, I had no one to call when I was in trouble because nobody would pick up the phone. So if you're at that point, or if you've been to that point, you don't have to try to go any lower. You know, this here is a magic. I was thinking this driving over. Is Alcoholics Anonymous the only answer? Absolutely not. There's probably 500 ways to get sober. Or like that song, 500 ways to leave your lover or something like that. Is that right? You figured out a couple. Anyway. But the bottom line is that Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing that worked for me. These simple 12 steps, they made it so simple. And as I told you, the sponsorship deal for me was the direct message from what I've come to find was a power greater than myself. I choose to call God only because that's his name, and he saved my life and does it regularly, day in and day out. And if when I talk about God, whether tonight or over the next number of weeks, and it scares you out of here, booze and drugs is going to scare you back in. But this is it, man. Where are you going to go? I mean, this is South Florida. It's the vacation capital of the world. It's 7 degrees in Boston. Maybe they had a heat wave today, 12 or something. You can't walk around. There's snow up to the third story. And here you are in South Florida, 75, 80 degrees, and everybody's really envious of you. They just don't know you live in a halfway house. Wow, you're in Florida. How lucky are you? Yeah, as long as I get on the van on time, I'm real fortunate. I mean, really. So you might as well enjoy the deal that you've been given. And I'm not ragging on halfway houses. I mean, it just, I got sober and clean before they had them. I mean, I'm serious. You know, it wasn't like you could roll from one bed to the next in Del Rey and go to another place. It's not the way it was. 1969, I was in a lot of trouble. I was at Woodstock. Everybody heard of that place? Well, I was really there. As a matter of fact, I was there with my first wife, who wasn't like where I proposed to her, but as we were rolling in the mud, somehow we ended up shortly thereafter getting married. And I wanted to stop right then, 1969. Nobody showed me how. I went to a therapeutic community. I was facing five felonies in Newport, Rhode Island from the Jazz Festival. I was facing 15 years in prison. But nobody ever said to me, if you don't take the first one, you can't end up in this trouble. No one ever said that. They said, put a sign around your neck. You come, you know, you're a bad person. You've got to modify everything. The only thing I had to modify when I got here was really very little, and just be waiting outside for you guys to pick me up to take me to a meeting. And so that's my responsibility. That's what I do today. From 1969 to 1980, I'll tell two stories. That's the other thing, you know, you get old, you can't see anything. Now I got it. This is a 2-hour meeting?
Correct.
Just wanted to make sure. Don't get scared. We know you got a curfew. Don't panic. It's all going to be okay. So anyway, 1969, I was in a lot of trouble already, and I wanted to stop, but I didn't know how. So back in New York, for people like me, they had these things called, it was a brand new program that had come out. It wasn't AA, it wasn't NA. It was called Methadone Maintenance. And they put me on that, and somehow I managed. I was okay for a number of years. In 1972, I got married. In 1974, my beautiful daughter was born, who was 40 now. Incredible, incredible kid. And I think about this because in 1976, which was a turning point when I was out there, I went off the deep end, I guess. So I don't even know if I've come back yet. But in 1976, what happened, I was doing very well financially. And when I was doing well financially, I wanted you to know it. Because if you start doing well financially in the program, you don't want anyone to know it. But back then, when I was doing well, because the family thought I was such a dirtbag, is I wanted, you know, like to show them I'm really not the black sheep. So what I did was, in February of 1976, I called my cousins in Maryland, and I was going to impress them. My daughter was 2 years old. I got tickets to the number one show on Broadway at that time, which was a show called Equus. It was with Anthony Perkins. Somebody said, huh? That impacted you too, huh? Maybe we were there together. Let me share with you my story from Equus. So I went to a scalper and I got the best show, the best seats at the Helen Hayes Theater on 45th Street and Broadway. And I called my cousins, Mark and Arlene, and I said, why don't you come on up? You'll see the baby who was, you know, under 2 years old, Lisa. We'll go to dinner. I'll take you to a nice dinner in Manhattan. And we'll go to the show, me figuring that they then would get the word out to the family about how well Paul was doing. You know, because the only other reports about Paul were he went through the window on the Long Island Expressway, he's in Rikers Island, he's in Queens House of Detention. I mean, there weren't like positive news stories. So I figured that was my game plan. That isn't quite the way it worked out. Let me share with you what happened. They drove 210 miles up from Pikesville, Maryland to come and see this show. saw my beautiful apartment in Bayside, Queens, and we got in my luxury car and we drove to Manhattan. I took them to Rossoff Steakhouse. We walked around the corner and we went to the Helen Hayes Theater, where on February 1st, 1976, I had second row center seats to this show, Equus, with Anthony Perkins, God rest his soul. And I never had a chance to make amends. Why would I owe him amends? Well, let me share what happened. Now, this show was a very somber, quiet, solemn, to the best of my recollection now, 30, 40 years later almost, this is what I remember. It's Anthony Perkins is the psychiatrist, and there's a make-believe horse on the stand, on the stage. Maybe it was a make-believe, I don't know, but he was talking to the audience as if they're his patients. Now, if you've ever been to a Broadway show, you know there's balconies and upper balconies, and it was jam-packed Saturday night. I'm in the second row, I'm right here to James. It was a very confusing play. Now, this is what happened. And a lot of what I tell you now is, like in the movies, it says, as told to. So a lot of this is what was relayed to me subsequent to this incident. Anthony Perkins, a fine actor, was speaking to the audience, and he evidently asked a question. Now, the other 1,800 people in the audience, they knew it's what was known as a rhetorical question. Sadly, I hadn't gotten that memo. So you just have to picture this. I often want to like get people to close their eyes, but not yet. But just picture this. We're all dressed, Saturday night, Broadway, New York City. Anthony Perkins with his pipe and his little horn-rimmed glasses asks the question. I jump up. Now, without this microphone, I have a pretty loud voice. And I say, that's because my name is Paul Efron. Share with you what happened from that moment. And we'll fast forward it. Well, a number of things happened, obviously. First of all, my wife and my cousin Mark looked behind me like, what just happened? My wife knew I was not an understudy for this role here. To this day, and nobody has been able to convince me differently, I believe that fully half of the theater thought I was in the play. Because it made no sense anyway. Would have made as much sense, some moron jumps up, second row, screams at the guy. But they knew I wasn't. They pulled me down. 10 minutes later, I did it again. We were asked to leave the theater. And that night, I woke up in Elmhurst General Psychiatric Prison Hospital. But here's the real key. The next 12 months of my life was spent going from one of those places to the next. I started off after that 10 or 12 days there, I went to this beautiful place called Hillside General Hospital, where they used to advertise in the New York Times, let your families come and stroll our luscious acreage and watch you make leather belts on the weekends. And that's what I did, and that's what they did. And the difference is back then is those were 90-day times. I don't know what happened, some with insurance, whatever. You guys could better speak to that. But it was 90 days, and I went from 90-day to 90-day to 90-day to 90-day. Every time they let me go with 90 days worth of medication, I took it that day. And it wasn't. I knew that it wasn't going to kill me. I just took it, then they'd pump my stomach, and they sent me to another place. Back then, by the way, those places were called mental hospitals, asylums, loony bins, nut houses, houses for the very, very nervous. Today, they're called treatment centers. And that's exactly, there is no difference, believe me. The same thing. The only difference is my last residence in New York State, after that end of that first year in 1976 into 77, was a place called Creedmoor State Hospital. And that is a place where if you're from New York, when your parents are driving you to the beach or to Long Island, and you're like me, they point and they say, if you don't straighten up, that's where you're going. I'm the only one that went. Somehow I got out. Some people think I'm still an outpatient, but I got out. And what happened is I became suicidal from this happy-go-lucky guy. Man, I was happy no matter what lot in life I was dealt. I never blamed anyone. It was the deal. Okay, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a junkie, this is it. If I'm in Harlem, if I'm in the Lower East Side, if I owe you money and you're chasing, what can I tell you? I wasn't like sad ever until in the middle of this mental hospital experience, I developed these tremors. I never want to forget this from some of the medications they were giving me. And I could not shampoo my hair. And that I want to remember, that the tremors were so great that I couldn't coordinate my hands to be able to shampoo my hair. And then finally, at the end of 76, I just had enough. I don't know if anyone here has ever really tried to commit suicide. You know, not just a Mickey Mouse thing, but I tried the full bore. I got a prescription for back then what was known as 3-grain Tylenols, and I took 26 of them. And 26 3-grain Tylenols would kill any half a row in any row. And anybody from the 60s knows that. And I was 145 pounds, so it's not like I had this great big body weight, but I had a much bigger weight, and I was a god. Because I was in a coma for 6.5 days in Long Island Jewish Hospital. And on the third day of that coma, because you're allowed to visit 10 minutes every 2 hours, they took my parents and my wife into the consultation room, and they said the following: don't waste the 10 minutes every 2 hours that you're allowed to visit, because if he happens to live, he's going to be a vegetable. So just accept right now that he's gone. They kept coming, they kept sitting at my bedside. 3.5 days later, I came out of that coma. Today I know it was the grace of his power, because I know that I had something to do. And this is part of what he had in mind for me to do. And that was in 1976. I didn't get clean back then. I spent another 3 years out there. I had another couple of arrests. I got thrown out of New York by my wife and the authorities, and I came down here. But that's when the evidence became evidence. You know, today they talk about evidence-based treatment. Well, I'm going to give you my evidence-based treatment, that in my mind, it's not even subject to discussion. The following few stories I'm going to tell you, knowing that I'm here because whatever it is I have to do isn't done. And that's why I'm still here. And part of the main thing I have to do is be responsible whenever anyone anywhere reaches out for this gift. I can't get this gift and go live on the Intercoastal and sit back and watch American Idol or whatever the hell you watch. I need to be on the firing lines. And it's, I go to more meetings today than you guys are recommended to go to when you're in treatment. No, I'm serious. I'm not joking. Why do I do that? Because I love the deal. My wife, we have a house in Long Island, and I go to a lot of meetings there too. I go to a 7:30 in the morning meeting, usually every morning. And I come back one day and she says, I just figured out why you go to all those meetings. And I said, what's that? She says, very much like the TV show Cheers, everyone likes to go someplace where everyone knows their name. And I said to her, I said, you know what, honey? You're 1,000% right. I love that. I love being recognized, not for what I did and I owe you for, but like this guy that came up to me today, remember me from 10 years ago when you tried to put me somewhere. Come on, what are you kidding me? I'm a mental patient, dysfunctional member of society. No, and by the way, does anyone here ever read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? No, I don't know. Sometimes, do they still use that? Okay, good. Because early on in the big book, it says something like this. Next week, I'll bring the book, but I was just got home from Tampa. I was had to take a nap. I was tired. It says something like this, really early on. We are a group of mental defectives in full flight from reality. And something else like that isn't like complimentary. This is the preface to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't write this. So if you read it, they're telling you that you really better latch on to this because you ended up getting here because things aren't working properly up here. And so now I'm going to tell you the story. Oh, great. I love this. Another hour and a half, we're good. Wow. Here we go. 1979, I moved down to Fort Lauderdale. By this time, I need to say, I was on Social Security disability insurance because the United States government had determined I had made money, that it was better for everyone if they paid me to not participate in the world. To this day, I wish I have had the chance to talk to Ronald Reagan because he was the guy that was kept giving me more money. I mean, for the first 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a paid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The United States government was sending me checks, $1,407 a month, tax-free, in 1980. That's living large. I was living on the Intercoastal. I was driving a Z car and going to 5 meetings a day. I was like, the only thing I had to do was shower and go to the mailbox on the third of the month. That was the extent of my issues. But that passed too, which we'll get to later in the steps. I got here, I was bouncing around in Fort Lauderdale, and this is when the beginning of this power revealing himself to me began. Because when I got sober and I got here, I didn't know if I was an agnostic or an atheist, and I found out I was an ignoramus. Because I really thought that I knew the answers. And anything I didn't know, I didn't want to hear. My favorite two words for a long time in sobriety were, I know. No matter what you were saying, oh, I know. Did you know? Oh, I know that. I mean, of course I know that. So here's what happened. I read an article in the newspaper in February of 1980. And the article was an interview with two people that had gotten clean and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous about a brand new program that was just starting. There was one meeting in all of Broward County called Narcotics Anonymous. Had narcotics in the headline. No, I have this like retention problem. It's a New York thing when people move like quickly. No, they don't understand. I'm still a mental patient. People move too quickly while I'm speaking. I lose everything. Anyway, so it's a good idea next week go to the bathroom before. Because then what happens, I lose my train of thought. Okay, so I read this article, and I make a phone call to the phone number that was in the article. And this guy came and picked me up. His name's Curtis. And I just reconnected with Curtis. I'll probably have him up here for, I didn't tell him about it, for one of these steps because he's back here now. And he comes and he takes me to this place on Southeast 6th Street in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, right next to the courthouse called St. Francis Mission. It's not the St. Francis Mission they have today. It was a little dank place right on 6th Street. And I walk in there, and there was six or seven people in this dark room, and they had the 12-step shades on the wall. And I don't know about you, but I sat there, and I looked around, and I said, it's just another place I don't belong. And I wasn't at a bottom, I need to tell you this. My bottom was 1969. This was 1980. I was already now getting money from the government. I had a place to live. I wasn't addicted to booze or drugs. I had money coming in from the United States government, and there weren't that many people looking for me because they were all in New York. So I was here in the sunshine. So I wasn't at a bottom by any means. And I got up and I went to this guy, Curtis, and I said, you know what, Curtis, I'm sorry I bothered you. If I ever need you, I'll be sure to give you a call. I'll get home on my own. And here's what happened, and this is exactly, this isn't as told to, this is what happened. At or about 8:28 p.m. on February 12th, 1980, as I'm walking out of the Lutheran Ministry, St. Francis Lutheran Ministry, in downtown Fort Lauderdale, in walks a guy from my block in Queens, New York City. A guy that I ran the streets with. A guy that his arrests were in the paper just like mine. We did the deal together out there. So, I mean, I didn't do any backflips. Oh, Mark, thank you, God. But what did happen is we hugged, and I ended up back in the room. And I went, it was only eight or nine people in the whole, that was the whole population of Narcotics Anonymous, as hard as it is to imagine, because it is for me hard to imagine. And I sat down on one of the couches, and I looked up to the front of the room, and Mark was the speaker that night. Now, let me tell you something. I, once again, didn't do backflips and say, oh, yeah, thank you, you know. But I'll tell you what did happen. I listened a little bit. And I didn't need to listen to his story because our stories were exactly the same. He sat in the front of that room, which is when I started paying attention, and he said, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink or a drug for 6 months. Maybe. Not that I ever did it for 6 months, but maybe I could. That I could sort of possibly wrap my arm around. Because I know Mark, very much like myself, couldn't go 6 weeks without putting something in his body. Couldn't go 6 days. Matter of fact, the only time I ever refused a drink or a drug is if I misunderstood the question. I wasn't the kind of person that ever said, no, thank you, I've had enough. And I haven't had enough of this. That's the beauty. That is the beauty. That's where the sickness and intensity of my addiction when I was out there has translated into the sickness and intensity of my recovery. And I just keep wanting more, because that's what I did out there. So Mark spoke at the front, and back then it was before Keytag, I don't even know. They had a white chip, a poker chip, and they said, anybody, whatever. I went up to the front of the room. I'm going to tell you something. That was February 12th, 1980. By God's grace, you people, I haven't found it necessary to pick up a chemical since that day. I just celebrated 35 years in a row. Nights, weekends, tragedies, traumas, marriages, divorces, bankruptcies, arrests, indictments, IRS liens, etc., etc. So what? That's life. I'm sober over half my life, so I've had over half my life of experiences. Just because you don't use and you don't drink does not mean you skip up the 12 golden steps of life and never have a negative emotion. What happens is if you don't drink and you don't drug and you come in here and you let us embrace you, no matter what happens, you will be able to handle it with God's help, the help of a sponsor, and the people. The people, to me, my God has skin on. Mark Friedman, God rest his soul, he died sober last year. 33 years sober. And he knows. And so there's a big void in my life last year when I picked up my medallion, because he always used to give me his medallion. He had 6 months more than me. And so now he's not here, so I mean, you know. He was called, he had prostate cancer, and he left. You know, we're all leaving, you know. I mean, none of us get to determine how or when. Key is you do the best you can, and when it's time to go, you hopefully say goodnight, Gracie, and hopefully you made an impact. Hopefully you made a difference. Because one thing I can tell you, the last 35 years, for the most part, I've made a positive difference. I mean, of course, there have been negative things. I mean, wives, obviously. Women, once they're not with you anymore, they're not the happiest about you. I mean, that's just sort of the way it works. But I have a beautiful son today. Oh, listen to this. I have a 29-year-old son that I never would have obviously met if I killed myself in 1976. Last Sunday, because the stuff just keeps on happening. Well, about a month ago, him and his great girlfriend, they live right by me in Coconut Creek, and they announced that she's pregnant. Wow, beautiful. And they announced it on Facebook, on Valentine's Day. You know, I'm like the only 67-year-old guy that is like Facebook. My daughter says to me, she's 40, she says, Daddy, you're the only, this was a couple years ago, she says, you're the only 65-year-old guy I know that has 3,000 friends on Facebook. And half of them are 30-year-old women. I said, at least I'm a chick magnet, that's what I tell you. I'm still hanging on to that, believe me, from the 60s, which I might have been, because everybody was so high. So anyway, last Sunday, this past Sunday, right here in a bar in Boca, right there, we rented a restaurant, and we had something which I'm sure I never heard of. It was called a gender reveal party. Has anybody ever heard of that?
No.
Let me share with you what it means. My friends thought it meant if you're transgender or determined, you know, because that's where I come from. That's my background. But that's really not what it was. Here's what it is. They went to the doctor, and they go with my son's best friend, Tommy. Tommy was the only one that the doctor told the sex of the baby. Tommy's a professional chef. So we have this party up here on Sunday. Tommy baked this big cake. And at the time they decided, because they had invitations with pink and with blue, and they cut the cake, which Tommy made, and if it's pink, it's a girl, and if it's blue, it's a boy. So, as of last Sunday, God willing, I'm going to be the grandfather of a grandson next September. Now, come on. Now, I mean, really, you know, I mean, it's great. Like, what did I do? I didn't do very much for that one. But the fact of the matter is, how's that possible? I'm a degenerate convict mental patient. Now I'm going to be a grandfather? And I go to these things, and I go to those things, and I have some respect around life. And, you know, I got sober. And I don't even know if anyone here would remember. Oh, Eddie would remember, and his buddy from Boston. The Iranian hostage crisis. Remember that? Okay. Well, I got sober right when that was happening. So I would come home every night, and on the news they would go, day 73, Iranian hostage crisis. Now, they kept them for a year, so they were counting my sobriety. I was pissed when they got released. Not really. Easy. But I mean, now, you know, I mean, what was I to do now? Because that's what I'll do. Now, I talked about sponsorship, which the whole time we're going to talk about. 5, 7, 3? Whatever? You don't ever say that to me. 10 minutes. Excuse me. I really should have been in the Catskills. I really always wanted to do that. Could never stand up. Yeah, but look at these. These are real mental patients. Where are they going to go? They don't have the keys to the van. They got to stand up. Like doing a bit in San Quentin. They're not going anywhere. They're there. Whether they're laughing or crying, they're there. Anyway, so I went from 145 pounds when I got sober. You got to understand, I came into my first meeting at the 101 Club the day after that NA meeting, 10 a.m. meeting. They picked me up, and I was wearing a three-piece blue suit. I was wearing this yellow Huggy Bear flowered shirt. I had a pimp hat. And I had an attaché case, and I had the walk. It was a year later you found out there was nothing in the attaché case. Jim Sullivan, who I love, was still very, very close. He lives in Jacksonville. We speak all the time. And he stopped me at the door to the 101. And he says, "Yo." He says, "We can see you have the answers." Very obvious. See the way you're dressed, we see the look, we see the walk. Do us a favor. Leave your brains outside the door when you walk in here. If we want to learn how to die, we're going to ask for your input. If you want to learn how to live, we suggest you sit down and shut up. They don't say that anymore, but... And I did, because I had something which my sponsor told me back then, and I realized I have it today, just in a different way, and it's the gift of desperation. And it was many, many years after he told me, it was years after he was gone, that I realized the gift of desperation is G-O-D. I didn't know that when he was saying it to me, but you know what? The God of my understanding allowed me to get that desperate, allowed me to get in the gutters of life, allowed me to get so low and to such pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And when I thought I couldn't go lower, I got lower yet. There was no end to the bad. I kept finding new bottoms. And somehow he picked me up by the scruff of the neck and he threw me in the middle of that first meeting. And I've been here ever since. I mean, I like to laugh, in case you didn't figure that out. And I just wouldn't have gotten it. There's no condemnation from the Big Book Study or any of that. I mean, I've been to all of those things. I've been to Joe and Charlie's things. I've been all of that. But I'm a guy that got thrown out of everything that I ever attended because it was had graduations, and it had rules, and it had study material. That's not me, which is why we have all of these different hats in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you know, some people, they look at me and say, what is he still high on? You know, because I really am not really all here. But the fact of the matter is, I love to laugh. I love it, and they've proven that laughter, they used to say it, I mean, I'm sure your parents, that laughter is the best medicine. Well, it's been proven. They did a survey, babies laugh 400 times a day. Adults laugh 7. Tonight we laugh more than 7. You're a baby, what do? You shit, you laugh, you eat. You shit. That's what I was doing in a mental hospital, the same thing. So I'm really working my way back to babydom. That's what I want to do. That's all I want. What do I want in the issues? Work? Yeah, you got to work. You got to pay your bills. You're in a relationship or you're not. I have a great wife today. Thank you, God. I mean, 22 years. Can you imagine a woman being with me for 22 years? Think about it. As a matter of fact, we just came back from New York. We had to go up last weekend, but I was at a friend of mine's anniversary in the snow. And we're coming back, and we get off the airplane here in Fort Lauderdale, and there's a woman I know. She's waiting for someone. So Sandra's walking right behind me, and I say, oh, no, she says to me, the girl says to me, Paul, is this your wife? And I know her from the Boca Pines Club. I say, yeah. She goes to Sandra. She says, how do you do it? I mean, really, what can I tell you? I mean, I guess there's a wrench for every nut, you know? Well, she was getting desperate. She had the gift of desperation. What can I tell you? I found out, I didn't invent this, that a grateful alcoholic won't drink and won't use. And so I was imprinted in my head from day one by Ray Allen and Fred T., God rest them both, to get grateful. And if you're not grateful, make believe you're grateful. And if you need a reminder, start writing a gratitude list. Nobody believes what I'm about to tell you. Maybe before this whole thing's over, I'll actually bring them in. I have 27 journals in my handwriting that chronicle my sobriety. I know where all the bodies are buried. I wrote them down. I don't know what I'm going to do with it when I die, but because there's a lot of stuff I wouldn't want anybody to see. But you know what? It's kept me on this side of the grass. That guy Curtis I was telling you about picked me up, took me to that first meeting. He was sober. He was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, got involved in building NA. After 4 or 5 years, he picked up. And then he tried to get back, and he couldn't. And then he started getting arrested for Mickey Mouse crimes. Well, Curtis, this red-headed, good-looking, muscle guy from Broward County, he ended up robbing 2 banks. He just got out of a 15-year prison sentence. Let me tell you something. He's back in Broward. And we go to meetings. You know, I take him to meetings. He's doing pretty well. He's working. But you want to talk about a different path. He took me to my first meeting, and the last 15 years of his life, while I've been skipping through the tulips, has been a nightmare. Hello, I would go down into prison when he was in Miami, and I'd have to take 3 showers when I came home. Half of the prisoners were lifers and rapists, and oh my God. And that was from picking up one chemical. Please, if you're going to get loaded, make a phone call first. That's the secret. That's what was told to me. There were a couple of times I wanted to get loaded since I'm sober. I thank you, God, that I didn't. And it doesn't matter how you pray, what you pray, or anything else. I'm just going to make a suggestion. Only because it was made to me. All of us have done a lot and said a lot of stupid things in jackpots, begging, humbly, crying, I don't have any money, you know, all of that stuff. When you go home tonight, you're alone, you're not alone, it doesn't even matter. And you don't have to get into a wilts and thous and dilts and shouts. Say one simple word, thanks. Because I'm going to tell you why. That, to me, is the most sincere prayer anyone can utter. And I'd say that a lot. I said it today, or whenever, or yesterday, saying the national anthem in the stadium. And after that, I said that, and I said, thanks. How is that possible that I'm standing here in the sunlight of the Spirit, out there, and I'm a productive, responsible member of society? I have respect today where I go. Man, give yourself a break. They used to say go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I don't hear that too much anymore. They say, well, if that's too much, go to a meeting. If that's too much, you're probably not hit a bottom yet. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And if you do this thing and you don't like where you're at after 90 days, I'll give you back your misery. Because that's what they told me. I'm tired of this soft soap and shit. And then you go to funerals every other hour. Man, I love you all. Thanks for listening.